You're tuned to The Weekend, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sines, your host for The Weekend, and joining us today is Lisa Falkenberg. Lisa is an award-winning journalist, not just an award-winning journalist, but a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. And we had the pleasure, our students had the pleasure of listening to her speak at UTEP recently, and she's been speaking to some of our classes, and she took some time out of her busy schedule to visit with us today as well. Lisa, thank you so much for being with us here.
Thank you for having me.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
A lot of times we end up writing accolades and for other people, but you received an accolade. You received a Pulitzer Prize for a commentary in 2015. So we'll talk a little bit about the prize in just a minute, but let's talk a little bit about your career. First of all, I want to let our listeners know that you are local. You're from Seguin, Texas. Mm-hmm. So we're proud to have you here. I'm from New Mexico officially, but I guess I've been in Texas long enough that I can consider myself a Texan. But you grew up in Seguin, Texas, and then you went on to school and got your degree in journalism. Tell us a little bit about, first of all, growing up in Seguin and what inspired you to get involved in journalism and have that interest?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was involved in the high school newspaper, which is funny enough, called the Cricket Chirps. I think it's actually, it claims to be the longest continuously publishing high school newspaper in the state. And it really was a great place for me because I always asked too many questions as a kid. And had this, I like to joke, I was the only redhead in my family. So I had lots of milkman jokes thrown at me. And I had a healthy degree of skepticism because of that. No, I love my father. He is a, he was a truck driver for many years. And we
did. Driving a milk truck?
No, it was not a milk truck.
Okay.
But we had no one in our family who had been to college. I was the first person to go. And we didn't have many books in our house. I was kind of this, you know, this freakish person who, with the red hair, loved to read and loved to write. And my mom would accuse me sometimes of plagiarism. Oh, where did you get that? You couldn't have written that. You know, what book did you get that from? And so, but I remember we didn't have many books, but we did have an old set of encyclopedias from the 60s. And if I had a question that my parents couldn't answer, there wasn't Google then, you know. And so my dad would go to the encyclopedias. And maybe the answer was in there and maybe it wasn't. But just seeing him go validated my curiosity for one thing and made me think the answer is somewhere. The answer is out there. Maybe not in those books, but it's somewhere. And so, I don't know, that was just an interesting thing growing up to see him go to the encyclopedias. It made me continue to ask questions, and I always just loved to write.
And just what kind of, because a lot of times I was considered a so-called, I guess, freak also when I was younger, mm-hmm. because I was always asking for microphones and tape recorders and stuff like that for Christmas or birthdays. Because you love to read and you love the encyclopedias, which we need to, I guess, talk about encyclopedias and what they are because, again, Google libraries. So did you spend a lot of time in your town library as well or school library?
Yes. Yeah, that was my favorite. I think they call them auxiliary classes today. You know, you go to PE or music. Or I love to go to the library and I love the librarian. There was this huge dictionary, so big that it had its own swivel, you know. Stand. And I just love the dictionary because what do they call annotated dictionaries? Because you could read the word and then it would tell you kind of the root of it. I don't know. For some reason, I've always loved words. And even if we didn't have books, we listened to a lot of country music. My parents did. And there's so many songwriters who are just wonderful storytellers. Merle Haggard, you know, is one of my favorites. And so I think some of the cadence, some of the rhythm of my writing, I probably got from listening to old country songs. I don't know. But yes, I don't know what it was, but from an early age, I will say my mom can talk your head off. And so now with all the brain research done, we realize if you talk to your children, you know, how much that stimulates the brain and helps the formation of the architecture of the brain and helps just the attention of talking to your children is so important. And so my little brain was probably just lit up all the time because of how much my mom talked to us.
And what about television. Did you watch television? And if you did, what did you enjoy watching?
You know, that's interesting. We did watch a lot of TV. And we had, I remember, there was a big event in our household. Probably I was in kindergarten when we got the Disney Channel. And so we grew up on a lot of the old classic, you know, Disney movies. So a lot of that. But, you know, I have to say, as a journalist, it was a difficult decision to make. We do not have cable in our house. We have a TV, and the kids every now and then, I have a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old. And every now and then, they get to watch a movie, or they have a little show that they really love, or they learn a lot about endangered species. But we are not a household where the TV is on, hardly ever. We don't have time for it, so we just stopped paying for it. But I think that so much what's on TV today is just inappropriate for young children. And I guess I want to shield my kids from that, but I also want them doing other things with their time, creating, building, reading. So that's what we do in our household.
And what about, you mentioned a little bit about high school, and then you made that decision to go on to school, college, and major in journalism. Did you already know you were going to major in journalism? And if you did, why did you pick the school that you did?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting. Yes, I knew I wanted to be a journalist from my freshman year in high school because I loved it so much. Do you mean to tell me there's a job where somebody will pay me to ask questions and pay me to write? And so I was hooked from the beginning. But the reason I applied to the University of Texas was because it was the only university, besides we do have a small one in Seguin, Texas Lutheran University, which at the time was a college. But UT was the only, you know, university I had really set foot on. And that was only because of journalism. We would go in the summers to some workshops and different UIL events. So it was the only school I applied to. And thank goodness they let me in. But the idea of going to college was overwhelming. UT Austin is bigger than my hometown, but I thought, I can do this, you know?
And did you feel pressure or overwhelmed by the fact that not only were you going to college, but you were the first one in your family to pursue a degree?
Yes, and at that time, I often tell this story, and my poor mother hates hearing it. But when I told my mother I wanted to go to college, her response was, "Why? You're so smart." And, you know, in her defense, I think that she thought I had had a few articles published in the local paper and I could just continue to do that and work in Seguin and not have to get the college debt. And in hindsight, maybe she was right because I had to win the Pulitzer to pay off the college debt. But she, you know, my parents loved me very much, but there were things they just knew nothing about. And when it came to applying for schools, now it's kind of easy. You can apply for several, I think, with one application. At that time, it wasn't like that. I mean, I don't even remember having counselors help me. And so I had to go seek out the applications and, you know, various scholarships. My father helped me with the FAFSA, the financial aid application, but yes, it was overwhelming and just no kind of guidance, really, you know?
What about, okay, once you got to school and now you're not in Seguin, you're not writing for the Cricket Chirp. Cricket Chirp?
Is it? Okay. Yeah, plural. Cricket Chirps.
Cricket Chirps. Okay. I thought it was maybe because of Buddy Holly in Texas.
And yeah, well, I think crickets. It really had to do with crickets. We have a lot of crickets in Seguin. So.
And so once you got to college and all of a sudden you're surrounded by other people who aspire to be journalists. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize that, yes, journalism is a team effort if you're working together with other reporters, photographers, whatever. But it's also an individual. And you had that drive, as your mom and dad saw. But all of a sudden you're competing against other people who have similar drives.
Right. Well, at the University of Texas at Austin, the student newspaper is called the Daily Texan. It's very well known. It is a student-run publication, and it's very competitive. And I remember going down there before school even started, we were there in the summer, my father and I, and I don't know if I remember letting him go down there with me or if I went down by myself, but I remember going in there and one of the editors said, well, we don't hire freshmen. Freshmen are not able to work here. And I thought, well, fine for everybody else, but I am going to. And so I brought my clips. I understand students don't know that word these days. That means my stories, my portfolio of work that I had done. And I told them I would be a very good reporter for them. And so I ended up getting a job. But it was constant. It was very competitive. It was inspiring at times. But you really have to just, like anything else, I mean, you have to try to work harder, longer than other people. I ended up, it's a very interesting story, I ended up having an editor who didn't like me very much. I think she wanted somebody else in my job, so she kind of nitpicked at me. And one day I walked in, and she's has a stern face and says, Falkenberg, get in my office. And she just looks at me and says, I know what you've been doing. And I thought, what have I been doing? You know, does she know something? I don't know. I don't know. She says, you have been fabricating quotes. And I thought to myself, and I'm the kind of person with so much anxiety or so much honesty, maybe that did I do this? She's accusing me of this. And I think, nope, never done that. And turns out, she says, well, we've had this official at the university call and say that he did not say the quote that you had him quoted as saying today in the paper. Immediately in my head, I understand what I did. I called basically the official and the guy under him really close together. One called back and I used the other guy's name. I never made that error again. But I was devastated by this error. And the editor really seized on it and in fact, insisted on going with me to interviews where I interviewed UT officials. So she really was, you know, trying to humiliate me. And eventually I ended up leaving the Texan because of that relationship with her. But it was a good thing because I went to work as a clerk in the Dallas Morning News Bureau. And that led to a whole series of professional jobs covering the legislature. And so if I had stayed at the Daily Texan, maybe I wouldn't have had those opportunities. And so I always tell that story because it's so important for kids to realize that, you know, that was devastating, that error, but it was a good time to make it. I'd rather make that error when I'm 20, however old I was, than when I'm 38, you know, or when I'm 50. So I learned a lesson, and it also, the path led me somewhere I think that was better for me.
We are visiting with Lisa Falkenberg. Lisa is a 2015 Pulitzer Prize winning journalist for commentary. And as we all are, the prize is most prestigious, the prestigious journalism award for journalism, journalists in television, radio. The Pulitzer Prize is just the Emmy, the Grammy, what can I say? It's the award. And you received that in 2015. But not just that, Lisa. You were a finalist in 2014. So as far as that goes, I'm sure you were surprised because we all are very critical of our work. And especially from what you've been telling me about your background, I'm sure that you went over and over again with what you've written or what you've done. Tell us about your job at the Houston Chronicle. And first of all, did you get that one right off the bat when you got out of college?
Well, that one was very interesting. People often ask me, so were you really surprised when you won the Pulitzer? And I said, no, I was surprised the year before when I was a finalist. Basically what happened, I had been doing the job for, 7, 8 years as a columnist. And we got new editors, new leadership at the paper. And one of them said, you know, we'd really like to enter your columns in the Pulitzer. And I thought, well, these new people, they just probably need a warm body, you know, somebody to put in the contest. And so in that year, there wasn't any particular focus to the columns. It was just a hodgepodge of work I had done that year. And so I remember that I got a text on the day the Pulitzers were announced that year in 2014. And it was from a former editor saying, congratulations. And I said, for what? And he said, you're a finalist in the Pulitzers. And I said, you know, you're kidding or something like that. And he says, go to the website. I didn't even know what day they were announcing them. It wasn't even on my radar. And so that year when I was a finalist was the biggest year to me. It changed something in my mind. I was in a realm with people I never even imagined being considered on their level, you know. And you all have to remember, maybe you don't know this, but the Houston Chronicle, in more than a century of existence, I think it was 114 years at that point, had never won a Pulitzer. Yes. And in fact, in all of Hearst, the company that owns Chronicle, I think this was the first writing Pulitzer for Hearst. And so this was really a milestone for the paper the next year, obviously, when I actually won. And it's not like I even went in the next year saying, well, this year I'm going to win. It just really happened serendipitously. I mean, I came across a very interesting story and intended to do one column, and it ended up being a series that changed Texas law and helped, I believe, it had some small role maybe in getting a man off death row.
And this is you're talking about the case involving Alfred Brown?
Yes.
For our listeners, if you wouldn't mind sharing with us a little bit
Sure.
about the background.
Okay. And so this was a case of a man named Alfred Duane Brown, who was convicted of killing a Houston police officer during a robbery of a check cashing store. There were two other people supposedly involved. And it was a devastating thing for Houston anytime a law enforcement officer is killed. And often there's a lot of passion, there's a lot of urgency involved in getting the person behind bars who did this. And this was the case with Alfred Brown. Now, he had always claimed he was innocent. No one believed him. There was no evidence supported at trial that made a compelling argument. He was convicted and sentenced to death. Years later, there was a private civil firm that was working pro bono on his case. And they get a call one day, and they hear that a box of documents, well, a homicide detective who worked on the case was cleaning out his garage and found a box of documents. Would they like to see the documents? And they say, yes, we would. The thing about Alfred Brown is he claimed he was innocent, but he also claimed around the time of the murder, he had made a landline phone call. Remember landlines? He had made a landline phone call from his girlfriend's to her workplace that would put him at his girlfriend's house and not off with the murderers. This evidence to support that was never presented at trial. Well, in this box, guess what was found? Among other things, yes, there was a phone record that showed he made the call, or the call was made at the time he said he made it. It was the same time Price is Right was on. So I think his girlfriend had remembered the time, but here was a piece of paper saying, there it is. And so they, you know, presented this information to the current district attorney. The district attorney at that time said, yes, we made a mistake in the law. This is called a Brady violation. You're supposed to, the prosecution is supposed to present any information that, exculpatory information to the defense. It was not done. The DA agreed to a new trial, but the appellate judges were just sitting on it and not giving him a new trial. So I thought I would just write one column saying, hey, you people in the black robes, get off your duffs, give this guy a new trial. But after I wrote that column, something still bothered me. The girlfriend had initially been the best alibi witness that Alfred Brown had. She ended up testifying against him at trial and helping him get the death penalty. Why would she do that? I wondered. And so I went to the courthouse. I started looking at documents in the case, and I found a grand jury transcript. I had never laid my hands on something like this. Grand juries are secret. This was a transcript of an actual grand jury questioning. And I was shocked. My jaw dropped at what was in there. The girlfriend was being questioned, but she was being interrogated, really. And the grand jurors were threatening to take away her children, threatening she would never get a job flipping burgers, threatening she would go to jail if she did not, quote, tell the truth. And what they wanted her to do was change her story. Eventually, she did. She changed her story and agreed to testify after they had jailed her, agreed to testify against Brown and helped him get the death. That led to more questions. Who are these grand jurors? A dog in the hunt. Why are they so, you know, adamant about getting her to change her story? I tried to figure out who the grand jurors were, And that led to the discovery that here we had, in the investigation of a murdered police officer, who is leading it? The foreman of the grand jury was a police officer himself and a colleague of the man who was murdered. And so that led to more. What I discovered was it's very common to have police officers on grand juries because in Texas at that time, we had a system called the Pick-a-Pal system, the nickname. Basically, a judge could pick a friend who could pick another friend to be on the grand jury. Now, needless to say, that led to a lot of bias in the system. A lot of law enforcement friendly people on there. And as a result of the columns, that grand jury system was abolished in Texas. The legislature did that with the leadership of Senator John Whitmire out of Houston. We became the last state in the union to ban it. And now we choose in Texas our grand jurors the way that we choose our trial jurors, very similarly, semi-randomly. And so Alfred Dwayne Brown was also freed from prison. He had a strong case before I wrote one word, but he ended up getting criminal appellate court in Texas, the highest court, overturned the conviction, and the district attorney didn't have enough evidence to retry him. He's now free, and he's a truck driver.
It sounds, you know, people listening to this who perhaps were not familiar with this case, going, well, that sounds like a John Grisham novel. And, and for those of fans of John Grisham, he did write a nonfiction called Presumed Innocent about somebody who was, quote, framed. What you did to win this prize, and you were just doing your job. Now, it was not that you were chasing a prize. However, some people may question now because, and as I was talking to some colleagues, in fact, our colleague Dino Kiecki, about journalism is not what it used to be anymore. Because if you want to watch something that affects your bias, you would go on the left. You would go on the right. But very few journalists are in the middle now. So you can choose who you want to listen to. Does that make your job harder, Lisa, because of what's being said about journalists, whether it be from the left or the right, but the fact that digging up evidence and doing other things like you did is hardly done anymore?
Well, I think it's done all the time. But the narrative nationally, you know, from the president, for instance, that journalists are enemy of the people. I mean, that is the rhetoric that's out there. But I think somewhere in people's minds, even if they want to hate journalists for whatever reason, they also understand, you know, that we're doing a lot of good, too. And they hear about these stories of wrongfully convicted people who are freed and exonerated. And the movie Spotlight did a great deal of, you know, focusing on the Boston Globe reporters and how they were able to reveal the sexual abuse going on in the Catholic Church. And so I think that people understand the great journalism that's still out there. And I will say, yes, our jobs are harder, but journalism probably has never been more important. You know, and it's not as if people are not reading. I think people are reading. They're just expecting to get all of the news for free because for years it was subsidized by advertising in the newspaper. But now that we're online and it's harder to make money off advertising online, it's harder to find the revenue that was lost with the classified ads and everything that used to be in a newspaper. So basically it is a business model problem. Somebody needs to come in and do for the news business what, I don't know, Apple did for the music business with iTunes. But until we figure that out, that's above my pay grade. Hopefully somebody will figure that out. But the fact is, we need journalism. People often ask, oh, is journalism dying? Well, if it dies, this country will die because you cannot have a democratic republic where people don't know what's going on. You cannot give people the power to choose their elected leaders and to have a voice in policy if they have no idea who those leaders are and what the policies are. And so as when I talk to young people, you know, and parents or whoever it is that I'm talking to, I just say, be aware. Be aware. Ask questions. Get outside your comfort zone. Yes, we have news silos now where we can aggregate our news and feel cuddled in the embrace of, you know, friendly opinions on Fox News or MSNBC and never have to feel the discomfort of reading an opinion that we don't agree with. But this is why I love newspaper readers. They're still paying to get agitated. You know, people read my column and they say, lady, you know, I don't agree with you hardly ever or only sometimes, but you make me think and I like the way you say it, whatever you're saying. And I appreciate those people. They pay for me to upset them a little, you know, and to question their philosophy on life. And we can't ever stop doing that. That's really important for Americans, especially.
We are visiting with Lisa Falkenberg. She is a journalist for the Houston Chronicle, also the 215, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for commentary, as she just mentioned earlier, on the Alfred Dwayne Brown case. Lisa, you mentioned something earlier also that has clicked and especially affected newsrooms, newspapers, the fact that the revenue doesn't seem to be there, so they are closing down, shutting down a lot of newspapers.
Right. I mean, you can probably remember better than I, but, you know, paper cities where there were three papers and certainly two papers. And that's becoming exceedingly rare these days. And that, like anything else, leads to less competition and, you know, perhaps less quality. Yes, I mean, eventually people will be on all of these news organizations, if they survive, will be online. And so in our newsroom, you know, we're making the transition and you hear a lot of grumbling and people, myself, you know, they want me to do a podcast or they want me to tweet and all of this. And I'm trying to manage that with my other duties. But it is important. You need to. Any industry needs to evolve, and you need to reach out to people where they are. You can't just keep producing a product in the same way and not, you know, and you just expect people to, you know, start reading newspapers who didn't grow up with that habit. Now, yeah, I talk to people all the time who maybe have a little gray in their hair, and they say, I can't imagine having my cereal or my coffee without my newspaper. But, and I grew up also with parents who read the local paper, but we, you know, I know a lot of younger people who don't see their parents doing that. And I have young children and they see us reading the newspaper all the time. But when I go speak to their classes, I hold up a newspaper and some of them know what it is and some of them don't. Or some of them say magazine or whatever. So anyway, things are changing. What is not going to change is the need for news, the need for people to be aware of what's going on in the world. And you know, that kind of scrutiny that only the you know, serious, fair journalism can give to our public officials and to every facet of our lives.
Lisa, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for taking the time to spend with us, having a conversation with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been visiting with Lisa Falkenberg. Lisa is a journalist for the Houston Chronicle, and she is also the winner of the 2015 Pulitzer Prize and a finalist in 2014. The Weekend is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Lauren Terrazas. You've been tuned to The Weekend. I'm Luis Sainz.